Welcome to this special interview with Tom Luongo on Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens. It is in New York City. It is the ninth day of March, 2023. Tom Luongo, he's the proprietor of the Gold, Goats, and Guns website. I've known of Tom by way of various articles I read over the years at Zero Hedge, and I have recently picked up on some of Tom's work, in fact, and the reason we're having this special discussion today is an article that he just recently wrote called "The War for the Dollar is Already Over." And some very unique ideas in there that I think are very important. I think so important, in fact, that I'm doing this special report, this special interview today, because it will have, if Tom is right about what he's going to tell you, it's going to have a profound effect on the markets and how you invest your money. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you, Jay. It's a real pleasure. As I said to you off camera before we started, you know, this is one of those interviews that I, you know, for me, it's like, oh, I get to be on Jay's show after listening to you for all these years. So,
well, the admiration is mutual, I must say, and I was delighted to see. I went back on LinkedIn or someplace, and I saw that we had a discussion some 10 years ago or so, and I just sort of, I don't know, I got busy and then I forgot. But I started reading your stuff more recently and said, well, I've got to have Tom on because I think you have some unique ideas that are that ring true to me. And so I think, and very important and profound, I think, in terms of how people invest their money. Well, it seems to me, Tom, that, you know, most of us are like Pavlov's dog. We start to have things that we enjoy. We like the way life is. We look for the bell to ring the next time so we can salivate and have more good times. It seems to me that's what people are doing in the stock market. Ever since Greenspan's put back in following 1987, well, we could expect that as soon as the market starts to crater in any significant way, the Fed will come to the rescue, start printing money, and off we are to the next party.
Yeah.
You, I think, are believing that that's not what Jay Powell is planning to do. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do. I don't blame anybody for thinking this. Like, the Fed trained us to believe this over the last 20 years or so. Certainly, when I spoke to Daniel DiMartino Booth a couple of weeks ago, you know, she reminded everybody that, you know, Greenspan was a guy who was an outcast, social outcast as a kid. So he really liked getting the limelight and being everybody's buddy by, you know, giving everybody what they wanted. And
right.
That was the kind of the start of it. And I think in some ways, you know, again, you can, you know, discount as much as you want in the personal foibles or faults of, you know, particular Fed chairman. But I think it's a valid lens through which to view some of Greenspan's actions. Bernanke and Yellen were classic academicians. To use Danielle's phrase, they were shockingly naive when I brought up the potential of her about thinking of the geopolitical angle on monetary policy and getting, you know, that they're doctrinaire Keynesians, to be generous to them. And I've tried to be generous to Bernanke over the years, even though I'm not personally, but, you know, so every once in a while when you sit down and you talk about these people, like, if I'm being generous to Bernanke, and I don't actually want to be, but I'll, for devil's advocate sake, I'll present the I have to be generous argument. I had to learn to do that when I was working at Newsmax because they didn't like it when I went that too far down this rabbit hole. So editorially speaking, I always had to kind of soften some of the things I was writing about even 10 years ago. That, you know, they just, this is, this made their policies made sense to them. And then, of course, in the process of them always pivoting, always giving the world the dollars that they wanted when they got into trouble, they're, in Daniel's words, shockingly naive about how that's twisted and taken and then used against them. So so a couple of things in background. One, I think that the dollar reserve standard ended in 2008 and that we had a 3-year period of instability. And then the coordinated central bank era of the global financial system began in 2011, right at the top of the gold bull market, when the U.S. debt was downgraded. And then they put together the big $500 billion slush fund between the SNB, the BOJ, the Bank of England, the ECB, and the Fed. And then everybody kind of coordinated monetary policy. And for the next 11 years, it was like round robin QE. It was the ECB's turn to inflate, and then everybody else could back off a little bit. And it was the Fed's turn, then the DOJ, and they just kept doing this and inflating the whole thing up. Powell is not cut from the same cloth as all these other people.
Right.
He's not an academician. He's a lawyer and a former private equity guy over Carlyle. And he was, as the junior member of the FOMC, was always the hawk. Was always the guy who never agreed with the 2% inflation target, never agreed with any of these things, right? So personnel is policy in this world. So now the question is Powell, if he's not cut from the same cloth as these people, and we are now staring at a globalist putsch to end the commercial banking as we've known it, to do away with the two-tiered monetary system,
right,
where we, the two-channel transmission system from the central bank to the commercial banks, and then from the commercial banks to us. The whole argument for retail CBDC is to do away with the commercial banks and just have all of us transact directly with the central bank and program the money so that if Christine Lagarde doesn't like the fact that, you know, you said nasty things about her, you weren't allowed to order a pizza or get a car loan or, you know, own a house or get any credit. That's the whole social credit score is built around the programmability of a CBDC. Well, if you're JP Morgan, if you're Jamie Dimon, if you're John Solomon over at Goldman Sachs, if you're any of these people, are you okay with this idea?
I don't think so.
Right. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. And who does the Federal Reserve, specifically the New York Fed, which is the most powerful of the 12 regional banks, who are the shareholders of the New York Fed?
They're the major banks, Morgan, the money Sachs, center banks.
Buffalo City, right?
Yeah, they're the money center banks. So the New York Fed has to look after those guys.
I agree.
So there's your motive, I guess.
There's your fundamental motive. But you can almost argue that they went along with this when everything could still be levered up and they were making money on it. But the banks in New York were never really happy with getting out of doing basic net interest margin style commercial banking.
Right.
And then having to be forced into the casino. I mean, yeah, you could argue there's probably some, again, each one of these banks are not a monolith, right? There are verticals within those. There's factions within JP Morgan. There's factions within Goldman Sachs who are fighting amongst themselves. So, but we can't get too granular on this because then it just becomes a complete mess. But just to in the broad scheme of things, they're not going to do anything that's in the long run that's going to do away with their business. When systems become, and people or anyone comes under existential threat, they fight back with everything they have.
Right.
So now, under Obama, there was no mechanism by which to take back control over monetary policy because Obama was selling the world out to European colonial globalists, what I like to call the Davos crowd.
Yeah.
And they were all in cahoots when everybody was making money. But once the system broke and we're into this coordinated central bank era and the banks were basically still, they're being cut out because there's no means by which for them to really go out and invest in good high IRR, investments. They have to go play in the money market casino. They have to go play in the derivative casino to make any money. We're at the zero bound. There's nothing, you know. So
you believe, Tom, that the system broke 2008,
mm-hmm.
and that's when this whole sort of merry-go-round of central banks taking their turns to create more money out of nothing. And so what you're saying is that some of these bankers, like J.P. Morgan and Citi and these guys, are understanding that the system is in trouble, and they, in order to preserve what they have, they need to... I guess bring back some integrity into the monetary system.
Sure, but
so we can have capitalism, Tom.
Right.
Well, because
but here's the thing. You're absolutely right. That is the thesis. But here's the gig. How do you do that when you don't have control over your own monetary policy? Because you don't have control over your own monetary policy because all of our debt is indexed to LIBOR, which is set by City of London.
Right.
18 money center banks, only one of which represent U.S. interest, which is J.P. Morgan's London office.
Right, Tom. And I think this is really profound. This is, I think, what very, very few people are thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
We're switching from LIBOR to, what do you call it?
SOFR.
SOFR. Tell us
SOFR, what SOFR. SOFR, the Secured Overnight Financing Rate.
Okay, so explain that maybe to people who aren't familiar.
Sure.
exactly
Okay.
what that is and how it differs from LIBOR and why it makes a difference.
Okay. So two things. So LIBOR is the London Interbank Offer Rate, which is an unsecured rate set at the end of the day by the 18 banks on the LIBOR board. They supposedly call each other up and say, well, what were you selling dollars for today? And what were you selling dollars for today? And then they come together and they say, okay, well, this will be the rate for tomorrow. Right. That is not based on any market, real market data. It is based on the opinions of the people who have a vested interest in setting that rate.
Oh, mm-hmm.
SOFR, the architect of whom is, by the way, John Williams, the head of the New York Fed, the most powerful of the 12 central banks, the 12 regional banks, which was put together back in 2008. SOFR was designed and in response to the financial crisis, the whole idea of replacing LIBOR and the LIBOR scandal of that time, right, when Barclays and the others, Northern Rock, and they got in trouble with setting the LIBOR rate. SOFR was actually on the drawing board for 10 years.
Wow.
And Geithner, Bernanke, Yellen, Obama, et cetera, put the kibosh on it.
All those academicians.
And all of those globalists.
Globalists, right.
They are absolutely, I don't believe Obama is an American patriot anyway. I think Obama is the original Manchurian candidate. I think he was elected to destroy the United States. I think the Biden administration is Obama's unofficial third term. I think he's doing everything imaginable. If you look at the Biden administration, you tell me one pro-American policy that the man has put in place.
Yeah, whether that was the motive or not, they're certainly doing it. That group of people is certainly destroying everything. That traditional values in America are being destroyed, thrown out the window very rapidly.
Yeah, I'm a terrible cynic, and I believe in I actually live by the adage now of distrust but verify, and I consider all these people vandals and traitors. Right. I'm blunt about this. I'm like, fight me, bro. Prove me wrong, because I can't. There's their record.
Yeah.
And we could spend 3 hours going over Obama's record and show all this, but let's just keep it to the banking system. If you are the commercial banks and you can see the plan on the horizon, this plan coming, because if anybody knows what the plan is, it's going to be these guys. You have to put in place a weapon or strategic asset
mm-hmm.
that would break this vicious cycle.
Right.
Because here's the thing. SOFR is a secured rate. It's based on the transactions on a day-to-day basis in the repo markets and in the money markets of you know, what are people actually buying and selling dollars for and coordinating their need for dollars through the futures market. That it's a collateralized rate. There are real assets backing up those transactions. So SOFR is a fundamentally superior product to LIBOR in every way. That's the first thing. And by the way, the article you're talking about was part one, because part two is going to come out later in the week, where I discuss the incentive structure as to why SOFR won.
Okay, that would be interesting.
This is important because
important
it's something
now.
That I talked about in a recent podcast I did with Vince Lanchi. People may know him as VBL. And my podcast, if for anybody's interest, is the Gold Goats and Guns podcast. You can find it anywhere. It's syndicated on every podcast app out there. So SOFR is superior to LIBOR for that reason. It's also based on domestic transactions. What are we buying and selling dollars for in the domestic markets? LIBOR is focused on the offshore dollar markets.
Yes.
You know, what is the needs of US dollars sitting in foreign bank accounts? These are known as euro dollars. And now we're talking about a guy like Jeff Snyder, who's popularized euro dollar theory. Now I'm working off of some of Jeff's previous work on this because he, you know, taught me this, but I went one step further and I said, look, Jeff has always maintained that the euro dollar system is the thing that is the tail that wags the Fed's dog.
Mm-hmm.
So that when the over leveraged, when leverage within the offshore dollar system starts to collapse, either because of economic contraction or, you know, whatever, doesn't matter. The Fed tries to raise rates.
Right.
What happens? LIBOR blows out far more than is happening in the domestic money markets here, but because all of our debt is indexed to LIBOR, all of our variable rate interest rates, your credit revolvers, your credit cards, your adjustable rate mortgages, your car loans, all of this stuff is tied to the LIBOR.
So right.
The City of London has literal control over our monetary policy.
Yeah.
And has, by the way,
right.
since before World War II.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And they also then can, by extension, control foreign policy and domestic spending policy. And we can get into MI6's owning of the CIA and the British deep state owning floors at Foggy Bottom in the State Department. Like, this is all well documented.
Yeah, it all connects with the money.
It all connects with City of London, the British Crown, the old money center banks in Europe, be it in Frankfurt, Milan, the Rotterdam, whatever, right? All of those old banks. Those are the people we're talking about. And they still want to have silent control over the global reserve currency's cost. And they had their shockingly naive, useful idiots running the Fed for 13 years, keeping the world at the zero bound. When money is that cheap, mm-hmm. right? Well, leverage explodes.
Right.
That's why Lehman got in trouble.
Sure.
Greenspan went from 6.5% to 2% or 1.5%, and Lehman went nuts in the mortgage markets and started selling, you know, CDOs and, you know, all these mortgage backed securities, and then they were worth nothing, and eventually, you know, the whole thing starts to collapse. Bernanke tries to raise interest rates, and the whole thing collapses. Mm-hmm. So here's the gig. The election of Trump, the reason they lost their minds over the election of Trump was because Trump got this, put his guy in as Treasury Secretary.
Uh-huh.
And then he got to nominate people to the Federal Reserve Board.
Right.
Powell gets confirmed as Federal Reserve Chair. Go back to 2017 and look up and do a Google search on all of the articles about how John Williams wasn't qualified to run the New York Fed.
Hmm. Interesting. Uh-huh.
They knew then, and I only did this now. I didn't realize this when I first started thinking in these terms. But it's clear that this fight started in 2017 with the implementation of SOFR and the beginning of the pilot project to replace LIBOR with a superior product, SOFR. Uh-huh. And you can't move a market against its desired trend. So if SOFR wasn't a superior product to LIBOR, it wouldn't have beat out LIBOR. So the article I wrote the other day was taking a victory lap on all of this stuff, because I've been talking about this for 2 years.
And, it's like, okay, look, and you're going to talk about in part two the reasons why SOFR became...
And other things like the petrodollar is dying, right. why the BRICS nations are going to tokenize gold, and all sorts of stuff that because it's the mechanism of a superior market or a superior product. Capital always flows to where it's treated best. Right. Right?
Interesting. Tom, before we go further, I'd just like to ask you, I mean, everybody believes that Powell is fighting inflation, and no. I would think that inflation is giving him cover.
Yes.
In part to do what he's doing, though.
Yes.
Because he can say, look, we got 6% inflation, you know, we got 4% rates, real rates are still negative. So that gives him the intellectual, that gives him cover.
Basically. He gets to play the Keynesian.
Right.
He gets to start and play Keynesian orthodoxy and use it against them.
I see. Uh-huh. And but he's not, you would say he's not a Keynesian.
I don't know if he is or he isn't. I know is, right. I Daniel Booth says I'm an economic agnostic. I'm not a monetarist. I'm not a Keynesian. I'm not an Austrian. She's like, I pick and choose from everybody. And I think Powell's the same kind of guy. I don't think Powell is a doctrinaire anything. Me, I'm a doctrinaire Austrian. Like like hardcore anarcho-capitalist. I have a picture of Murray Rothbard on my ceiling, like the whole nine yards, right?
Yeah.
But I'm also practical about this and understanding that there's an order of operations that has to happen if we want to get to where we want to go, which is something closer to sound money. We're not going to get there anytime soon, certainly not within your lifetime or mine.
Right.
We've got a long way to go to get there. But I believe that we're at the beginning of, because this system has been taken to its crisis point. Then it's either we go to CBDCs and divorce money from all work and all opportunity costs completely, or we pull back. Right. So have we reached the top of the cycle or not? As Martin Armstrong will put it, is this the top of this particular cycle? Mm-hmm. And are we going to move into the next one? So this is where my thinking is on this.
Right.
So if you think of it this way, if you are the commercial banks and you do want to survive, and now you have an opportunity with this guy, Trump, in power, you can put the right Federal Reserve chair in with the right head of the New York Fed to put in a superior product, SOFR, which would then end LIBOR. So generally speaking, the euro dollar system is a LIBOR based system. Euro dollar futures take their cues from the LIBOR curve, right? LIBOR is, by the way, ending on June 30th.
Right. You mentioned that's a date to really watch and keep a close eye on, because what you're saying then is SOFR will take over.
Oh, SOFR has already taken over.
It already is dominant.
Yes. It has dominance in the liquidity of the dollar futures markets between SOFR and the Fed funds futures market. Those are the dominant markets now. But they're taking their cues from LIBOR, because there's still a lot of LIBOR denominated debt out there, but it's all foreign.
It will wind off by June 30th, essentially.
Well, and the CME, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, reminded everybody on, you know, last week, oh, by the way, we told you back in October that we were ending euro dollar futures trading on the CME. So if you guys want to trade a LIBOR based futures product, you're not doing it in Chicago. So that's nice. So there's no liquidity now in euro dollar futures in a LIBOR based product.
Right.
So SOFR is now the law of the land. All new US debt issued after January 1st, 2022 had to be indexed to SOFR. That was part of the 5-year rollout of SOFR.
Okay, so let me understand, Tom, that this CIBOR will meet the needs of Americans' capital markets, America's.
Yes.
And before it was an international thing, it wasn't.
Yeah. In broad strokes, that is correct. Yes.
But it goes also to the idea that we have to own the world's reserve currency. As I understand it, we had to run massive trade deficits, chronic trade deficits, so that there was all these dollars sloshing around out there in the economy. And that's why we got rid of our value added businesses, really, and our high wage. Yeah. Mining, manufacturing, anything that creates wealth, wealth creating jobs. And we become financialized to such an extent.
Yes.
And those banks that used to do the traditional lending. And I mean, I started out in New York as a credit analyst, and I felt it was a decent, respectable job, because we were trying to protect the bank's capital and the shareholder or the depositors' wealth,
right?
You know, by making sure we were lending money to responsible, that we were going to get our money back. And that to me was morally good. I could be a banker and not be an evil banker. I could be one that helped to allocate credit efficiently. So what you're telling me is that this new CIBOR what's it called?
SOFR
should SOFR. Really help to bring this sort of lending back.
Yeah, well, it is. It's going to preserve the commercial banking sector of the United States against in order for us to survive this, we have to have a commercial banking system.
Right.
We have to have private formation of capital. We have to have private risk assessment. We have to get back to having credit analysts actually care about the quality of the loans that the bank is going to invest in. Right.
Exactly.
We don't have that today. But we haven't. And you only get back to that when you have a market rate of interest.
Right. And I remember the time when I was still a banker that they were getting rid of credit analysts, essentially. And they were just bundling loans by, you know, tens and, you know, dozens and dozens of major loans, throw them in one package, and a certain number of them will fail. Okay, we'll factor that into the pricing. We don't care. We're not going to spend the human capital to do all this hard work to try to understand whether or not we were lending.
And we're going to lay the risk off on the investors in the synthetic product, and just tell them, you know, caveat emptor. And when the Fed and when inflation and savings rate is negative or, you know, low, and this is the big one. Martin Armstrong talks about this all the time, that the real impetus for why stuff like that happened was because you have defined benefit pension systems all around the West promising 8% returns. And the best you can do in the markets was 2 or 3%. So you had to go get 8%. How did you do it? You went and you bought a leveraged product that promised more than 8%.
Yeah.
Right. So who needs credit analysts when you can do this?
Right.
This is what, and if you think it happened, it only happened here, you're nuts. It happened all, it's worse in Europe.
Right. Right.
And then it's even worse in Europe than it is in the United States, because at the very least for the companies in the United States that do produce wealth, that do produce things like Apple and, you know, and others, they can issue corporate debt. We issue corporate debt here in the United States, and they have their own credit ratings. In Europe, it's all bank debt. When a company wants to go, like when any, the Italian, you know, state oil company wants to expand their business, they got to go to Intesa San Paolo or UniCredit or whomever and go get a bank loan. They don't issue corporate debt the way we do. Okay? They don't have a corporate paper market like we do. So their banks are far more vulnerable to any kind of rate shock, i.e. the Fed raising rates, than our markets are.
Right. So this game could go on and on for a while. But ultimately, the laws of economics won't allow it to continue. The system is at the breaking point. And the answer that all the Marxists have is, well, hell, we'll just give it all to the government. Let the government tell us. And then they can, with the new technologies, can follow us around. Like they're doing in China, essentially. Yeah. Credit scores.
They're doing it here in the United States. I mean, and look at banks like BofA, you know, willingly turning over gun purchases without even a warrant, without anything. Just, oh, by the way, we're good citizens and we don't like gun owners and we're going to turn over your private financial information after we change the EULA on your credit card without, you know, in the dead of night. And then somehow that's legal. Like it's ridiculous. Jay, it's all commies, dude. And I'm very, very happy to say Comintern never ended. It's just been on autopilot since 1947. It's terrible what's been going on. Excuse me.
Right.
So, and you can see the impetus here. It is the slow and march through the institutions to take out the vestiges of capitalism and decry that capitalism's the bad guy the entire time. Well, these people are destroying private markets and destroying capital markets. And we have younger generations so divorced from the idea of what private production of capital actually looks like
that
they just think this is capitalism.
No,
like they've been propagandized. And like, I have news for you, dude. You have no idea what capitalism is.
Looks
like.
No, that's so exactly right.
It's crazy. You know.
Well, here's the thing, Tom. I remember, I think I'm a little older than you. I'm 76. I remember very well when I was a young man, when Volcker pulled the rug out from under me as a gold investor in 1980. And shortly thereafter, Mrs. Taylor and I bought our first house. It was a 17.5% mortgage. Okay, the world was different, but we only had a 35, I think it was debt to GDP was only 35% then. It's like 130% now. I recall having a discussion with Ron Paul and Mark Faber at a dinner in San Francisco. A bunch of Austrians were there. And I said, is there any chance, this was like in mid-90s, I said, is there any chance that we would have another Paul Volcker that would pull things back into alignment so that capital counted again? And there was not a chance. Neither Ron nor Mark thought there would be a chance at all. And our debt to GDP at that time was not nearly as where it is
today.
So I mean, that certainly, to get this thing fixed, to restore capitalism, to restore the market's decision on what capital costs, it's going to be a very, very painful situation. I mean, do you think that Powell can withstand this?
I do, because he's now got 3 years and he's got the banking sector behind him. And another Austrian, I was reminded of this the other day by somebody who actually had dinner with Dr. Gary North, big fan of Ron Paul, big fan of Mark Faber, big fan of all those guys. But Dr. North was, he was my dude. Like I no one likes Gary North now, you know, because he always said the inconvenient thing, which is, by the way, for example, back in 2008, when QE started, 2009, QE started, he said, there's not going to be any hyperinflation. There's going to be stagflation. Why? Bernanke's printed all this money, but he's not letting it out into the global economy. Like, he was right about everything. Well, so when Peter Schiff and Harry S. Dent were arguing about inflation versus deflation and all that stuff back then, North was like, that's not going to happen. And I was sitting there listening to them going, there's going to be commodity inflation and credit deflation, and you're both right and you're both wrong. That was me in 2008 in my laboratory in a startup company in South Florida listening to this stuff going, dudes, can you not see what's happening here? Because there are a lot of people out there who are good, who are Austrian economists, and a lot of them who aren't very, very good Austrian economists.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. North was probably the best of his generation of understanding the political angle as well as the raw monetary theory and everything else. And what North said at a dinner that the patron just literally DM'd me about this like 3 or 4 days ago, I said, look, when push comes to shove, the commercial banking system, to save itself, will destroy the American economy if they have to. They will do that in order to save themselves. Now, that was him back then without a global picture of what the real problem was. And I think, you know, a lot of the first generation Austrians really missed the whole global dollar problem, the euro dollar problem. I think they missed it. Fair enough. Like Austrian business cycle theory, this is all one, two generations old. Like, and it's very, I don't blame anybody for this. Like, don't ever take this as a rebuke. It's an observation. And so I look at this and we're all standing on the shoulders of these giants trying to figure out what's going on here. So when you start to factor all these other imperatives in, when you start to think about what Europe wants and what they're building in the European Union, okay, and then you look at, you know, the big geopolitical fight between the West and the East and all these other and all these other attendant conflicts, the monetary policy doesn't operate in a vacuum. And it doesn't operate in the vacuum of U.S. domestic economic statistics. I'm sorry, it doesn't. And everybody who does, but it's an easy thing for people to do because it's comfortable. Oh, I've got the CPI data and I can correlate it to that. It doesn't mean anything because tomorrow we could turn around and nuke Moscow. Like, who cares? Yeah. Like, this is the world we live in today. So you have to factor all of this stuff in.
Right.
So think of it this way. Would they be willing to burn the entire existing structure of the system down? Yes. Are there ways to recapitalize the United States with a massive debt to GDP ratio? Yes. Is it something that was previously unthinkable to two generations worth of hard money guys? Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I have a lot of thoughts on that as well. And I'll bring somebody else into this that you probably know of and heard of.
Yeah.
So let's think about this. So the switch from SOFR to LIBOR is the Fed getting control over it. Is the SOFR was the weapon that the commercial banks and the Fed, in broad strokes, is the weapon used to point back out at the offshore dollar markets and say, excuse me, we're in charge of monetary policy, not you.
Uh-huh.
That's what that means in the big, big picture.
Right.
Don't get lost in the minutiae. Don't get all Asperger-y about, oh my God, how is this going to work with cross-currency basis swaps and all. It doesn't matter. This is what's happening. This is the big thing. They've already worked all this other stuff out. You have to get control of the fiscal side of the equation.
Right.
And the Europeans control Congress and they control the White House. You can see it in the policy.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
You can see it in why they put Joe Biden in office and they didn't let Trump be reelected. And I firmly believe the election was rigged and all of this stuff. I firmly believe all of this. I've written about it. I'm on record about it and I don't care. And you can, again, fight me, bro. You don't have to believe, you don't have to agree with me, but
yeah,
you know, prove me wrong. I haven't seen it yet. I'm going to assume distrust, but verify. Now, if they started that process of the five-year switchover from an inferior product to a superior product from LIBOR to SOFR, they already knew that they were going to win once the project was running, as long as they had the right guy at the top of that institution, in this case, Powell, to shepherd it through to its completion. And then when there was no other argument, there was no good political argument for spending more money because inflation started to rise, as you said earlier,
there was the cover story.
So what Powell did was he went along with the transitory argument for a long time while the political game played itself out on Capitol Hill, knowing full well that all the money that was printed through the CARES Act would file into the system, the economy would start to come back, inflation would get out of control, and it would undermine the arguments for why we needed $6 trillion in Build Back Better, why we needed this bloated infrastructure bill, why we needed any of these things. We have a booming economy. Why do we need this stuff?
Right.
And I was like, yeah, why do we need this stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Inflation is now structural. Huh, interesting, raising rates. And when I first looked at this stuff, I said, you know, if I'm right about this, what I want to see is Powell just like tear the Band-Aid off and start raising rates by 50, 75 basis points. Every time Obama looked at him sideways, he's like, look, you think 50 is bad? It's 75. Look at me sideways again, and I'll make it 100. I'm sorry, 125? Really? Like, this is, if I was Powell, every time I was summoned to the White House, that's exactly the conversation I would have had with him. I'm like, no, I'm just not doing this. I'm Italian and I'm macho, so I would just get an ungovernable and prickly. So I'd be like, oh, really? You think you're in control? That's air you think you're breathing. We're going 125 in a week. Deal with it. Like, that would have been me. That's why I'm not Fed chair.
Well, yeah.
But you know, thankfully, Powell's a much more staid and placid personality, thankfully, because if it was me, this whole thing would have, I would have ripped the band-aid off and we'd be at 8%, and you know,
well, I mean,
they would have lynched me by now, but it would have been fun. It would have been fun while it lasted.
So, I mean, we're going to see how this plays out. If you're right and Powell is going to stick to his guns, as you suggest, for the reasons you suggest, which makes sense to me, in part because I think what Volcker did way back in 1980 mm-hmm. was in part geopolitical. I think the Europeans, I mean, this wasn't widely understood, but the Europeans were saying, well, if you don't get your house in order, we're not going to buy any more of your treasuries, you know? And so I think that was part of the
reason. And by the way, the exact reverse happened in 2019. If you guys, Europe, don't get off of the negative bound, and you stopped trying to sell to the market that German Bund, 10-year Bunds should be trading at -1%, then we're not going to take it as repo collateral.
Yeah.
At par. Yeah. And JP Morgan was the first bank to get off that train. Martin Armstrong mentioned this in passing. This is part of the reason why I put all this stuff together. Like, he's like, JP Morgan in 2019 caused the repo crisis by September by refusing to take as collateral any European sovereign debt at par.
Mm-hmm.
They probably Jamie Dimon sat back. That guy's Greek. He would have done the 70 cents, Draghi. I'll buy German Bunds at 70 cents. What are you, nuts? You think that stuff is literally worth a, you know, 165? No, I'll give you 125 for them. 120. And it's like Draghi's like, absolutely not. And that froze the markets. And Powell knew what was going to happen. And of course, he had to eventually step in. And, you know, stuff was going to break, but it was the beginning of the decoupling of the American banking system from the European banking system. Right. And now today, not one American bank takes European sovereign debt as repo collateral. If the Europeans want U.S. treasuries, they got to buy them from the Fed. Because in June in the June 16th, 2021 FOMC meeting, Powell raised the reverse repo rate 5 basis points above the Fed funds rate, which sucked all this money into the reverse repo facility.
Right.
Then what I talk about that all the time. What I talk about less is that the July 28th meeting, he then opened up a foreign repo facility. So here he's got a big now with that. So this is what he did. He says, if you want treasuries, you got to come to the Fed to buy them at whatever we're selling them for. Now he's got a big stock of treasuries sitting on the Fed's balance sheet. He's got a big stock of money, liquidity, sitting in the reverse repo facility. And if the American banks get into trouble and they need collateral, well, we'll just increase QT.
Right.
We'll sell those treasuries into the market. And if it needs liquidity, we'll, you know. And so what Danielle and I talked about 2 weeks ago was that, look, as these raised rates, the reverse repo facility's outstanding balances dropped from $2.5 trillion down to $2 trillion. And it's falling regularly. Money's being pushed back into the money markets. Which is a good thing. We haven't had money in the money markets for 15 years.
Yeah, where it belongs. Well, Tom, let me just ask you this then, maybe in wrapping up here. repercussions then, in terms of how people are investing. I mean, obviously, how should people, if they buy your scenario, how should they respond? How should their portfolios look?
It's funny. I haven't had a chance to publish the article, the podcast yet, but I talked to Ted Oakley over at Oxbow on Monday or Tuesday, and I'll publish that when I get done with this thing. That's like the next thing on my to-do list for today. He was talking about, he's like, he's buying variable rate treasuries directly from the Treasury Department. And that way he's can ride it all the way up and get out of the trade. And when Powell pivots and comes down, he doesn't know when,
like,
why time the market? And, but at the same time, the way out for the United States is something I alluded to earlier and didn't get a chance to talk about. Go back and listen to Trump and Mnuchin talk about 50 and 100-year bonds. Remember when they floated that idea? What was not discussed at the time because was that the real plan was 50 and 100-year bonds with a gold redemption clause. And that was the architect of Judy Sheldon, who was also supposed to be put on the Federal Reserve Board and Kamala Harris and John McCain high-fived on the floor of the Senate when they blocked her nomination.
That's crazy. She would have been.
Because Shelton would have been in place on the FOMC board to facilitate that switchover, because we can recapitalize the United States and deal with rising and keep interest rates high if you do a gold redemption clause. And as Vince Lanci puts it, throw gold out onto the yield curve where it belongs and reverse the removing gold from the monetary system, slowly introduce it back into the monetary system by creating a sounder money than the old money, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let it take time. Doesn't need to go. We don't need to go to a gold standard overnight. Just throw it out there and, you know, and structure a product that's what, I don't know, maybe a 2% dollar nominal coupon with a 5% gold redemption clause.
Sure.
Now, all of a sudden, who's incentivized to allow the price of gold to rise as opposed to constantly squashing it?
So squashing it. Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
Federal Reserve of all people.
Yeah, one more thing, Tom, real quickly, and I don't know if this can be, maybe I shouldn't even bring it up because it's going to open up another topic. But for example, what's going on with China and Russia, the Shanghai Exchange, which has a futures exchange in oil and gold,
mm-hmm.
the Saudi Arabians now warming up to the Chinese, selling their oil to China for yuan, not dollars,
mm-hmm.
backing away from the dollar. And the, you know, the Saudis can get yuan for their oil sales and turn it into gold.
And they can hedge it on the two different sites. There's the onshore SGE exchange, and then there's the offshore one in Hong Kong. I can't remember the name, but I actually wrote about this exact mechanism in a Gold Goats and Guns newsletter about two or three months ago.
Oh, okay.
So in talking about this very issue, there's a bigger play here, which is the following. They're setting up an alternative financial system.
Right, for sure.
With tokenized, to offset or to deal with the buildup and the trade balances of people of each of these countries transacting in local currencies. So the Turks buying gas from the Russians in lira, and the Russians not wanting the lira, and they don't have enough trade to send the lira back to Turkey to buy, you know, washing machines and mung beans or whatever. Like that process, and same thing between Italy, India and Iran for oil, and China and Pakistan or whatever. You put them all on the same system where they're all building up these reserves, and every month or so you tokenize their gold reserves.
Right.
And the gold doesn't leave, but you just credit the accounts with a tokenized gold
settlement
system. And then they can still go out and buy gold in the real market, keep adding it to their reserves and do whatever. That's what's coming.
Yeah.
That system is already 75% built.
Absolutely. And I have to think that's not an unknown to Powell.
Oh, of course not.
I don't think, but we never hear that as any kind of a virtuous system, you know, in the propaganda, do we?
No, we don't. And the thing is that one of the other angles on this, if you're not convinced by all the SOFR, LIBOR, blah, 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 commercial banks argument, ready? De-dollarization itself of the East is the other thing that Powell is fighting.
Right.
That's the real linchpin to this whole thing. Because if he doesn't make the dollar valuable again and set the stage for a fiscal revolution on Congress, where Congress finally pulls back on the purse strings, starts doing the Ron Paul thing. Oh, hey, why don't we set the budget back to 2018 levels? Let's get crazy and set the budget back 4 years, like Ron used to talk about when he was running for president. All right. If we do that, and we've got a Federal Reserve chair willing to go up to 7%, which is where I think he's going, and keep it there for a while, maybe go back to 6.5 or two, but start to, you know, push the rate through 2024, 2025, 2026 into the 6-7 range and to keep it there for a few years. That makes the dollar attractive to still be a good trade settlement currency and a good investment currency. And we get fiscal responsibility starting to filter back into Washington. And we stop talking about tranny bathrooms and we start talking about, you know, building pipelines.
Right.
If we get into the, if that's the model, which in broad strokes, I think it is, then the East doesn't have to use their financial nuclear weapon,
mm-hmm.
which is to then have the Russians turn around and go, it's either gold or rubles for our oil.
Right.
Okay. Putin has made that threat. He's played that game a little bit. The system is still too complex for that to actually happen. The incentive structure isn't quite in place for that to happen. But the threat is there. and watch the Chinese divesting themselves of U.S. treasuries very carefully. Watch the Japanese very carefully. I've got another, I haven't even gotten into that yet. And, but over the, maybe we can do another one of these in a couple of weeks or a month or so. And I'll be happy to update, because I've got two big things that I want to talk about in the next month or so that I think are signposts of where we're headed.
Right. I heard you talking on a podcast, I think last night, about the Bank of Japan. Yes. And I wanted to ask you, is there some tie in with what's going on with Powell?
There absolutely is. Yeah. And my thoughts on what's going on with Japan, with the Bank of Japan, are still in flux, because trying to read the Bank of Japan at this point is very, very difficult, because it also ties into the political system and everything else. You know, it can, the Bank of Japan can either be the last thing to be, the thing to be sacrificed on Davos's altar for one last attempt to try and take down the Fed, or the change in leadership could be, oh, by the way, even the Bank of Japan is no longer in your backyard. You're Powell's boy now. And if the Bank of Japan, and we'll know if they, if the new guy loosens yield curve control, if he allows the Japanese long end of the bond yield, bond curve to start rising, then he's doing Powell's work for him, because now he'll break down all of these credit spreads that have been kind of frozen in amber, thanks to the thanks to the Eurodollar system and Christine Lagarde's ever more esoteric monetary policy.
Well, we're going to have to leave it go at that, Tom. I want to thank you so much. I guess before we say goodbye, though, you should tell people where they can go to sign up for your service. I've penetrated the paywall now with a very nominal, I think, a very reasonably priced Patreon, I am, and very, very good service. And so just quickly tell people.
Sure. The blog is over at tomluongo.me, or you can search Gold, Goats, and Guns. You'll find it. There's a podcast, same name, on any podcast, on any podcast platform. I cross-post them all together to the blog. The public posts that you see on Zero Hedge all originate on the blog. And then Zero Hedge just scrapes them with my permission, which is great. I love them for doing it. And then there's the Patreon. The Patreon is basically a two-tiered service. For $4 a month, it is a, I do twice weekly market reports, which are both 15 minutes of me ranting and then half an hour of me going over charts of strategic markets and trying to tie everything together as to what's happening into one cohesive theme. I also do bespoke chart reads for people, for patrons, if they ask for them. So if you have a stock that you want me to do a chart read on, I'll be happy to. I'm a, I think I'm pretty proficient technical analyst. I have, I got prop traders as patrons. They're like, dude, your analysis is excellent. I use this confirmatorily for what I, for the systems that I use. So, and then we do a, we do that. I also write privately for my patrons as well, once or twice a week, private blog posts. So anything that you see publicly may have already been workshopped by me first for the patrons. And then once a month, we also put out an investment newsletter, which is a kind of classic retail style. It's got a portfolio associated with it, all bespoke, all original material. Both myself and my partner, Dexter White, who's been on the podcast many times, we write about this and we think ahead of where we're going. And it's not just where we are, but where we're going.
Well, and, obviously, obviously, Tom, you're very passionate about what you do. You work extremely hard, but I know you love what you do. That comes through loud and clear when you're on the show. You know, I'm just in listening to you here. And your work is so diligent, so I think it's really great. Just one last thing I forgot to ask you. Given your views, then, I guess that gold, we're not looking for higher gold prices anytime soon, perhaps. We're looking,
I don't know. You know, Jay, it's going to be interesting. Like, there's going to be that moment where Powell's going to have to continue raising interest rates. And the raising of interest rates is about loss of institutional confidence. And loss of institutional confidence, there's three types of inflation. There's cost push, which we've been dealing with, and Powell's powerless against. There's demand pull, which we all want, and the Keynesians believe is the only type. And then there's loss of institutional confidence, and that's the one that Powell's trying to save on.
Right.
And we're somewhere between the two of them. I'm still very bullish on gold, maybe not in the short term, but it's like everything else. We've destroyed the Eurodollar futures market with this, which was the most evil of all markets. The gold futures market is also incredibly evil. Shanghai market is a physically settled market now rising to meet the inferior CME market. And again, it gets down to which market is rising in liquidity, which market is falling in liquidity. That's telling you that's where the market signals really matter. Okay, not necessarily the prices, but whose markets are going to reign supreme in the long run. Capital flows to where it's treated best. So even if the price of gold languishes, if the Chinese keep taking market share and Dubai keeps taking market share and Moscow keeps taking market share from London and Chicago, then the old system of suppression is failing.
Right.
And the new system of based on the physical demand is rising.
Right. And it's not hard to see how confidence could be lost with rising interest rates and a 30 some trillion budget debt load that the U.S. has to finance. I mean, at some point in time, people are going to realize the arithmetic doesn't work and the wheels are falling off the wagon. Tom, I want to thank you so much. You're very generous with your time, and it's and your insights are greatly appreciated. Thank you so much for being with us. And I look forward to doing it again sometime if you're willing and able. Thank you so
much. Absolutely, Jay. Thank you very much for the invite. And it was great to get into this part of the gold space, which every once in a while I tend to, not say the nicest things about, because we really need to shock people out of their complacency, and for no other reason than we need to. I'm very Randian about this. Like certain, when things don't work, you have to check your premises.
Sure.
And I'm an old chemist. Like I'm a scientist first and everything else second. Like if the hypothesis ain't working, dude, you can't fit the data back to beg the hypothesis.
Right,
you've got to bag the hypothesis and move forward.
You gotta face the truth, even if you don't like it. All right.
Even if it's inconvenient.
Absolutely. All right, Tom. Well, thank you so much. And folks, just a reminder, next week, Wednesday, same time, 3 o'clock Eastern time, we're going to have our next show, and that Alistair MacLeod will be with me to talk about interest rates, the silent killer. And Cherry Leadon, she's the geologist and CEO of Gold Bull Resources, will join me as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.